Welcome, welcome, one and all. Sit down by the fire, grab some eggnog, have a turkey leg and join me here at the Bitter End podcast for the start of season 8, all about Home Alone with me, Todd Jordan. Now, before we begin, I've been sat... Hang on. Me, Todd Jordan. Something's missing. I forgot Tom! Mate.
Fucking hell, dude.
I'm so...
What the fuck?
I had a lot to do.
Mate, you guest slot on like one podcast without me, and all of a sudden I am expendable. This is some bullshit. Hello, it's me, Tom Denny here, welcoming you to The Bitter End, Season 8, where we're watching the Home Alone franchise.
It's gonna be big. 5 movies, very festive, I believe kicked off by Mr... Is it Chris Columbus? The mastermind behind, I want to say, at least one of the Harry Potter movies. It's not really something I know about, but I think he's...
Oh, yeah, yeah, I think he was in... He had his fingers in some pies for that. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Like, a slightly different twist on some of the franchises we've been watching before. A bit more family-friendly, but still incredibly violent.
Hooray!
Hooray for that. And also just, you know... The nights are drawing in, it's getting cold, it's time for something festive. And what is more festive than a child, like, murdering 2 grown men?
Now, okay, I've got a few things to say about this movie.
Yeah.
Number one, it's only okay. I'm not particularly enamoured with the movie. I watch it once a year, at Christmas, when I can fall asleep in front of it.
See, I haven't even watched it that many times. I think I must have seen it at the cinema when it came out. And I've probably seen it maybe once more, but it comes up on all those, like, you know, like lists of like best family films, best holiday films. And yeah, I need to see if this stands up.
Yeah. So point number one for me is that, like, I'm perfectly happy to sit down and watch Home Alone when I'm surrounded by my family and we can all chuckle together about the same old stuff. This is going to be a different kettle of fish.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be, when we actually do the watch, it's going to be me on my own, you on a train somewhere else. It's going to feel odd, Tom.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I think it's important. You know, it's like a controlled experiment that we're just watching this on our own to be like, is it actually any good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Point two that I want to raise is just about the poster, the DVD, the trailer, everything. Mm. If you look at the typography of how they present Home Alone, I've always wondered this. The word alone, it's all written in capitals except for a lowercase e, which is slightly crooked.
What's that about?
What does that mean? Does that mean anything?
I have no idea.
Why?
I don't know, because you've already got the house in the middle between Home Alone, so you don't need to do anything more jazzy with your font, your typography.
Yeah.
Unless they were doing something to try and differentiate it a little bit more from the Home Improvements logo.
Is Macaulay meant to be the E, and because he's not capital, he's little?
Yes, I guess so.
But then why is it wonky?
Because he's wacky, he's a renegade, he's a rebel.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm unconvinced.
We watched the trailer. And I don't really feel I need to watch the film now. It had all the greatest hits in it.
It's got all the greatest hits from the last 15 minutes of the movie. This is my other beef.
Yeah.
The trailer and, like, popular consciousness would definitely have you think that this movie is just 2 solid hours of, like, Macaulay Culkin throwing paint pots into Daniel Stern's face. And there's very little of that in the actual movie. It's a lot of family drama.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, like, him bonding with the creepy old man who sorts the paths.
Forgot about him entirely.
Oh, he's the best bit.
Oh, okay.
But it's not the wacky Looney Tunes cartoon violence romp.
Yeah, John Candy's in it. I'm sure he's going to light up the screen when he's in there.
I mean, yeah, the cast is sick. Like, John Candy, Catherine O'Hara, Daniel Stern, Joe Pesci, Macaulay Culkin, the one and only Tom.
Macaulay Culkin, my old mate Macaulay Culkin. The trailer actually does quite a good job of teasing out kind of like the premise of what, you know, it's like kind of they really build on the whole thing of, like, what have these people forgotten? What have these people forgotten? They've forgotten a fucking child. The monsters.
Macklemore Culkin himself.
I know, they've left him behind. I always also, like, was just a bit confused when I watched this when I was younger about the dynamics of this family going on holiday. I was like, why are there so fucking many of them? So I'm looking forward to being... I think when I was a kid, I probably didn't really, like, take on board, like, wait, why are there so many?
I think it's more than one family. And
yeah.
But, you know, we'll get to that.
And we should go and get stuck into this film, Uno Momento. But first, Todd Jordan, welcome back to playing the IMDb guessing game. It's been a while since you've been on the show.
It's been so long.
I'm glad to have you here. So let's kick things off with season 8, Home Alone from 1990. What do you reckon this has been rated on IMDb? Bear in mind all these things we've been saying about how well regarded this is as a family Christmas romp.
I think this is routinely voted at least within the top 5 Christmas movies, like year after year after year. So, and also, I'm used to IMDb guessing for like horror movies, which tend to trend quite low on the scores front. I feel like movies from people's childhood are going to... they're going to trend higher because people quite like their childhoods generally.
Yeah.
Or like to think that they do.
Oh, yeah. Wake up, sheeple.
Yeah. So I'm going to go 8 on the nose.
Whoa, that is a big ballsy score. And I'm here to tell you, it's not as high as that.
Okay.
But it is still probably one of, if not the highest rated films that we have watched.
What have
like
we got,
ever.
Buddy?
7.5.
That's pretty high.
That's a big chunk of change.
That is a spicy meatball.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily saying that I felt it deserved an 8, but that's the way I thought the public were going to go.
That's how history has judged it. Well, history can go fuck itself. It's time for us to judge it. Buckle up, Macklemore Culkin.
Gather round, children, and listen to me tell this dark and eerie cautionary tale of lost souls. Yes, the story of the worst people alive suffering for their sins. Tom, this is the story of Home Alone.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you. There's some terror. It's a film about abuse.
It's fucking
neglect.
It's fucking bleak.
Yeah.
It is just everybody in it is horrible and everybody pays a heavy price. Not all of which will be immediately apparent.
Right, okay.
But, you know, I'm prepared to dig deeper beneath the surface to try and find a modicum of substance in this 1-hour, 45-minute montage.
I think this is a film we need to dig deep because watching this film on my own, as you did, now we've come together, I don't think that's how this film is meant to be watched. I don't think it's meant to be viewed in isolation.
No. I tell you what else, it's definitely not meant to be viewed on an empty stomach.
Right, okay.
It's not meant to be viewed alone. Yep. It's not meant to be viewed in October, like we are watching it now.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. So it was a very different kind of watch. Like, I can't think of when I actually saw this film last. I would have been in short trousers.
Yeah, I watch it every year. It's like my Christmas nodding off movie, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah. See, like, I might have seen a little bit of it on telly, but I think I've seen it in just clip form, you know, like for the past... I don't know, 25 years or something.
I mean, the movie is a clip show. It's almost entirely a montage. And this drives me insane.
And it's got some very different tones going on, depending on, like, who is on screen. The tones vary quite a lot. So, yeah, like, for me, like, watching this, I haven't seen it for a fucking age, and it's no longer like a... it's not like a slapstick, rough-and-tumble family comedy. I was kind of watching it and be like, right, so I'm going to delve deep into, like, the family dynamics that are going on here.
There's some wrong-uns in there. There's some bad apples in that barrel.
Let's get right into it.
Yeah, now, I don't think we should delve as much into the plot as we normally do, because I'm assuming the majority of our listeners will be quite familiar with Home Alone. We can absolutely run through the plot, but I don't think we need to, like... you know.
Yeah, I think it's more about looking about... It's about the minutia. It's about the family dynamics. It's about the character studies that are going on in this film.
So, Tom, where do we begin?
We begin with a fucking John Williams score. This started, and I thought, hang on. This sounds like... it sounded like the beginning of a horror film. It was like a black screen with, like, snow. And I was like, this kind of, like, eerie...
la 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 la
like, yeah, this sounds like a horror movie. Who did this? And then it suddenly goes full on Harry Potter whimsy. It's like, oh, it's probably John Williams.
And it is.
And it was.
And it's a fine score. It's you know, it's probably the best thing about the movie. As most movies are. The best thing about them is always the score.
Yeah, I mean, you're a big score fan.
I am.
Right, now, and then we're straight into this huge fucking house that all Americans seem to have in films and television.
My God, how much is this Chicago house worth?
Oh my God, and what do they do? What do they do for a living? That's what I want to know. They've got, so this is the thing with the film, when it came out, I was very confused with what the family situation was, because you're introducing this house and it is packed to the gills with
15 people. 15 people in the house.
That's too many people. I mean, you've got room for them in this huge house, and they're all running around, and you've got, stood in the middle of the hallway, Joe Pesci, dressed as a policeman, and he is trying to get someone's fucking attention, and you think that a policeman stood in the middle of your front room would get your attention, but absolutely not.
Nobody gives little Joey Fishers the respect he deserves.
No, not at all. The law just gets no respect in Chicago. Lawless community of billionaires and their fucking mansions, apparently. He's there trying to get some attention. And there's a bit. You got the mum.
Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah, and I think he manages to flag her down just to try and be kind of like... He's just kind of like, hey, what's going on here? Are you guys going away for the holidays or something? I'm Joe Pesci. Yeah, how's it going? And she... I was like, right, this is good. I can finally, after all these years, pin down what is the family arrangement. And I had to rewind it, and I still didn't get it, because for some reason, in all the scenes, there's like another scene later on where they're explaining where they're going to Paris for the holiday, maybe to see his... The husband's brother or her brother.
Did you really not find this? It's pretty basic.
No, because her performance is pure fucking like 90s mumblecore, like indie. Like she's just kind of like. She's like, I thought I'd just do it really like naturalistic and underplayed in just these sections of the film, and then everything else will be operating at like 11.
Do you want me to pull back the curtain for you, Tom?
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
Okay.
So for some reason, Catherine O'Hara and her husband have 5 kids.
Are they Catholic?
I think they might be. The film has got some pretty heavily Catholic overtones ways. They've got 5 kids, so that's all, and then the 2 parents, so that's already 7 people. That explains nearly half of the people in the house.
Okay.
Right. Then you've got her brother, Uncle Frank.
I like Uncle Frank.
He's a prick.
He's a prick, Mike. He's a likable
prick. He's a likable prick.
Apparently written for Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, Kelsey Grammer would have been the tits. So then you got him and his kids.
Yeah.
Right. Probably beefs it up a bit. And then there's one additional girl. Her parents are already in Paris. That's where they live.
Yeah.
So she's come over to stay with the Macaulay Culkin clan. And then they're all returning together for Christmas. That's it. Two families.
It's all too complicated.
2 families, one extra girl.
No, I don't like it. Because the bit that confused me when I was a kid, Joe Pesci's standing there going like, oh, all these, like, your parents here? Are your parents? Who are your parents? Who are your parents? All these kids, no parents. Must be a fancy orphanage. And so when I was a kid, I was like, are they all orphans?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Poor little Joey Fishers.
It would explain why they had so many fucking kids in there. Anyway, this was just like me unpicking some shit from my youth about not understanding a very basic film.
Right. Okay, good. I'm glad that this has been a useful session for you today, Tom.
It has been. Moving on, Mac and Me Culkin. He's there. He's playing Kevin. He's a little shit.
Oh my God, he's so... Just everything about him is unlikable and all made all the worse by the fact that I just know when I saw this at the cinema, I obviously thought he was the coolest.
Yeah, I mean, watching this film back, it's pure kind of like meant to be like wish fulfillment for kids. Being like, oh, imagine if I didn't have grown-ups around, what would I do? And we'll get into this later on, but the things that he does, after a while, just become very mundane.
Yeah, they're rubbish.
They're really rubbish. You think it's going to be like this big kind of like, yeah, let's give the kids the power. At one point, he does laundry.
Yeah.
That's not what you would do. Yeah.
But it's also just like about the way he talks. He talks like a fucking Harvard dropout who started writing for sitcoms. So it's like he was playing around in the garage or something, and the mum's like, you're not supposed to play around in the garage. And what he says to his mum is, did I burn down the joint? I don't think so. And that is neither a clever thing to say nor a funny thing to say.
Yeah, he's just being a bit of a knob.
But it's delivered as if it's a joke.
Yeah.
And there's so many moments in this where McColney, says things as if they're jokes, but then if you write them down and say them back, they are absolutely not jokes.
But is he also meant to be kind of aware that there is a camera there? Because there's a lot of bits where it's like he barrels the camera and delivers a line to you, the audience. But then times when you're like, is that what they were going for?
Well, what I think is happening, I mean, we'll get into this as it goes on a bit, but I am convinced that the only way to explain the behaviour in this movie is that as it goes on, McColney's character of Kevin McAllister begins to realise that he is a fictional character in a film. And then at first he like rebels against it by like addressing the camera, kind of pleading logic, pleading for release. And then over time he's kind of the existential like prison that he's built for himself is too much to bear, and he has to just plunge headlong into the fantasy.
Oh yeah, he goes for it. There's a point where he goes, and that's when the film gets kind of melancholy.
It's so bleak. Yeah. It's so bleak. Imagine realizing that you only exist in the mind of like a 35-year-old screenwriter, you know?
Yeah, that's dark. I like this. This is a good dark reading of this festive family favourite.
Yeah.
Into that.
It is October at the time that we record, Tom, so I'm going dark.
Okay, well, this is good. This is good.
You know who else is dark as fuck?
Who?
McColney's brother, Buzz.
Yeah.
He's got a pet tarantula.
Yep.
He's
got a sick iced tea poster in his bedroom wall.
Yeah, sick IT poster. IT?
IT? Come on, he's not a dork.
Yeah, no way. And he also says, like, incredibly over-laboured lines, but some of his are a bit more funny. So McColney is like, can I sleep in your room tonight? And Buzz says, I wouldn't let you sleep in my room if you were growing on my ass.
I like that line.
And
I noted
line is
that
actually
down.
Funny.
Yeah, that was good.
Because I just like the picture of him like sleeping in his room, but with his ass hanging out the door.
Yeah.
He says, fuck you, little brother.
Yeah, I'm into that. There's this whole thing. Everyone's walking around the house. They're all being horrible to each other. No one is particularly likable because all of Kevin's siblings just hate him.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of reason given other than Kevin's instant dislikability.
That is the reason. But, I am on all of his siblings' side.
But he's also meant to be completely incompetent. Like, he's a mama's boy, like, he can't tie his shoes. They say to him, go and pack your suitcase, Kevin. But he is... How old is he in this?
I don't know, like, maybe...
Six?
I think he's probably a bit older, but playing younger.
Yeah, I think he said he's in the second grade.
Okay.
So...
And he's like, what is the drama with packing your suitcase? They're like, pack your suitcase. He's like, I can't do that. I've never packed my suitcase before. Mate, you zip it up.
And you put some shit in there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's a tiny kid. Of course he doesn't know how to pack his suitcase.
You put some shit in and zip it up.
Yeah. He gets called les incompétents because they're going to Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah. By some child. Later I work out that it's a sister. Yeah.
Dude, this movie really went over your head.
Where did all these kids come from? Is it a school?
You know which kid I like?
Who?
McColney's cousin Fuller.
Played by his brother.
Played by his real brother. And he's the cousin who Kevin's being told he has to share a bed with, who's gonna wet the bed. And there's all these shots where he cuts over to Fuller and he's drinking a big glass of milk and raising his eyebrows at the camera being like, oh yeah, you know what's going to happen tonight. I'm going to piss all over everything. My thing.
This is what I liked. I remembered this from seeing, like, this is like an enduring memory of this film from like when I was a kid, is that there's the kid that wets the bed, but he, most importantly, he likes it. He's like really kind of like, he's like, you know, slugging down a Pepsi and he's kind of like, oh, it's going to make some good piss later.
It's his raison d'etre.
He's so into it.
He just lives to turn liquids into one specific liquid.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great equaliser. And another thing that we get introduced at this early kind of clusterfuck of people is the Shovel Slayer.
Yes, Mr. Marley, who is the, Buzz tells Kevin, is the South Bend Shovel Slayer.
Sick name.
Yes, sick name. He's the creepy old man who lives next door.
He looks like Jim Henson's ghost, basically.
Right, yes, okay, I can picture that exactly.
Yeah.
And the story goes that he murdered his family, put them all in his bucket of salt, which turned them into like mummies. And now he's like scattering the salt around the neighborhood. And if he sees you, he will kill you with a shovel.
So when this came up, I was like thinking, Todd, do you want to see that film?
I absolutely want to see the South Bend Shovel Slayer movie.
Ah, there's a spin-off there. The extended Home Alone universe.
They fucking missed a trick, mate.
Yeah. So that's introduced. That's kind of cool. I completely forgot that was even a thing in this film.
Yeah.
It's like we were saying before. I remember it being intro and the end. And there's like, an hour and 20 minutes that I'd completely forgotten existed.
Which might as well not exist. I think I've said this before, but it's worth pointing out. This film is catastrophically long for a children's film. It's an hour and 45. Now, I don't want to come across that I don't like this film, because I actually do like this film. But my God, when you watch it outside of the socially acceptable confines of a Christmas movie, an hour and 45, are you shitting me?
Yeah, for a film that was basically written around a slapstick routine.
Yeah.
But
we get two key plot points early on. One is the pizzas. So
we've got to talk about these fucking pizzas.
They've ordered 10 pizzas to feed 15 people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit stingy if you ask me. I would probably go 15 people. I mean, I would probably get 15 pizzas for 15 people, probably.
I mean, some of them are quite small kids. They're not going to eat.
That's true,
Macaulay Culkin and Kieran Culkin, they're not going to eat a lot. Kieran's definitely not going to eat a lot because he's just more on a liquid diet. Got to make that piss, though. But the important thing is that Kevin, he is a basic bitch. He only wants a plain cheese pizza. Go fuck yourself, mate.
This drives me insane. Yeah. He's like, you know that I don't like olives. And I'm like, okay, fine. I didn't like olives when I was a kid. And he goes, or sausage. What kid doesn't like sausage?
On a fucking pizza. Come on, mate. Put a little bit of pepperoni on there. Also, onion. Come on, bro. What is going on? And this, I remember being kind of incensed by this as a little youngster. I was just kind of like, you fucking... I was on there, stood on my seat in the cinema, shouting at the screen, you're a basic bitch, mate. You're a basic bitch. My mum had to get me to sit down. She said, let it go, let it go. We can have some pizza with some sausage on later. I was like, yeah, good, because I'm not a fucking little pussy like this guy.
Shots fired.
Yeah. Yeah, come at me, Mackinley.
Yeah, yeah. And so fucking Macklemore Culkin's disgust over the lack of a cheese pizza leads to the next very important plot point, which kind of explains the real nexus of the whole movie, and it's addressed in such a quick shot that a lot of people probably miss it. So Macklemore gets in a fight with his brother Buzz and results in Macklemore getting violent, pushing Buzz over. Some liquids get knocked. Fuller gets his face smushed up against the wall and probably pisses his pants.
Well,
he was like, I was saving that for later.
Yeah. It's basically like all boils down to they spill some Pepsi.
And they spill some Pepsi on
yeah.
a pile of magazines underneath which is one of the plane tickets.
Oh!
Yes.
Okay, I thought it was just like they spilled... Like, I remember, you spilled something as a kid, it's a bit annoying. It's like, oh,
no,
shit.
This is the thing it's that causes the important. Whole disaster. So the dad, like, scoops up all of the wet magazines, not noticing there's a wet plane ticket in there as well, picks it up, puts it in the bin. This is why later on, when they get to the airport and they're all boarding the plane, they don't notice that they have one too many plane tickets because one of them got chucked in the bloody bin.
Fuck me.
So if,
miss that.
Yeah, if Macklemore had just been happy to eat a fucking sausage...
None of this would None have ever happened. They'd have all gone to Paris and it all would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
Right. I get you. And then there's this bit with Uncle Frank, douchey Uncle Frank, where like everyone's just really annoyed at Kevin and he just like, oh, what does he fucking scream? He's just like, look what you did, you little jerk. And then everybody is just silent and they stare at Kevin. And it's almost like the bit in like The Graduate, you know, when he's been banging on the glass and it all goes quiet and you see people mouthing at him, but you can't hit. And it's like, oh my God, something is...
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, but I was just thinking like that everyone's going to turn around and look at Frank and be like, he is like six or something, and he's not your son. I know he's your family, but like if I shouted like that at my nephew, I would be the bad guy. But everyone's just kind of like, yeah, Frank's just saying what we're all thinking.
Yeah.
What's wrong with sausage?
Exactly. Exactly. And then my favourite other insult that gets thrown at Mac Daddy Culkin is his other brother, who I don't think has a name, says,
Kevin, you're such a disease.
That's a good one.
Now, I love that line and it's always stuck in my head since 1990. I've had that line in my head bursting to get out. I don't know many people called Kevin, and the ones that I've met have usually been pretty nice, so I don't get to call them a disease.
Hold in there. Like, one day, You'll meet some rat bag who really deserves it. And then he gets sent up to his room. Mum's kind of like, I've had enough of you. I'm a horrible character. You're a horrible character. Let's just call it quits for the day, shall we?
Yep.
And then they're all like, right, we all got to get up early in the morning and we've got to fly to the airport, bloody, bloody, blah. Kevin wishes. He makes a Christmas wish. He's like, I wish I didn't have a family. And then everything that happens, like the whimsical music and like a close-up of Father Christmas on the terrifying Father Christmas on the wreath they have on the front door, all this makes you think, like, hang about, is this actually magic? Are we meant to believe that this is actually magic that is now going to cause the power to be cut to their house? All the alarm clocks go off, they wake up late, creating this mad rush to get out of the house, and in all of that, Kevin gets left behind. Is it meant to be magic?
I think that's just something there to get the kids' imaginations going. It works without magic. So the other things that get into play, so we've lost the ticket because of the cheese pizza incident. There is a power cut because of a storm in the night, which means they all sleep in and they've only got 45 minutes to get to the airport.
What different times this was made in.
I'm sorry, 45 minutes for an international flight.
In the 90s,
45 minutes.
We lived in a more innocent time back then, but yes, still.
That is some bollocks. And then there's the other thing that comes into play is there's this nosy neighbor kid called Mitch Murphy.
Yes.
He's just like hanging out around their house, asking questions and stuff. And he is about the same age and height as Mac Daddy. And so when they're doing the head count, like terrible, terrible people, they just like put their hands on the head and they accidentally count the neighbor kid as Kevin.
Yeah.
Everybody in, missing ticket. And then the last thing is like the selfish asshole parents they are when they do get on the plane, they've booked all of the kids in coach.
Oh yeah, this is unbelievable.
And all of the parents in first class where they can drink the champagne, so they don't even notice that Kevin's not sitting down.
Yeah, and then the mum says to the dad, like, do you feel kind of bad that we put the kids in coach and we're in first class? And dad's like, nah, fuck you, dude. But so they've created all of this chaos to be like, well, absolutely no one knows where Kevin is. And even when they get on the plane, the stewardess is like, just grab the seats that are empty. So you're getting the idea that like the kids aren't even all going to be sat next to each other. They're all going to be scattered around. Even still, 15 people is meant to be there and not one of them has noticed, because it's all meant to be like put down on the parents. The parents haven't realized. What about all the fucking kids?
Nobody likes him. Nobody gives a shit about Macaulay Culkin, so they don't care.
Fair enough.
Now, this actually did remind me, Tom, you might be thinking, who could possibly forget their child? And again, I know this comes up a lot, but we have a lot of international listeners. People outside of the UK might not know about the time that the Prime Minister of the UK left his daughter in the pub.
Yeah, fuck you, Cameron.
Yes, so the previous Prime Minister of the UK, David Cameron, and his wife went to the pub for some sort of photo shooty thing.
Yeah.
Where they were literally just, they went to the pub, had a drink and maybe a bite to eat while some people took photos, and then they fucked off back to Downing Street or whatever, and they left their daughter in the pub. This is a real thing that the person running our country did.
Oh, it suddenly just makes me think that, look, this film is absolutely fine.
Yeah, I know. And that certainly wasn't the worst thing that Cameron did in his entire tenure.
Oh, no. But fuck you, Cameron.
It's almost the most forgivable thing he did.
Do you think he was doing it to try and win favour with the public by doing, like, I was doing a bit. It was a meta bit. I was doing Home Alone. Did you see that?
Sadly, I think not.
Okay. Anyway, Cameron doesn't get a pass, and neither will this film, but nice little sidebar there, Todd. I enjoyed that. Anyway, Mum realises, oh shit, I'm a monster.
Damn right.
They get to Paris, and they start trying to get back. Meanwhile, Kev wakes up at home. He's like, oh, this is brilliant. Time to do some child wish fulfillment. Bit of a montage. He jumps on the bed eating popcorn. He eats loads of ice cream and watches a gangster movie.
Yeah, a gangster movie, which is, I was much more interested in just on top of the VCR. There's a Springsteen DVD.
Oh, yes.
Oh, sorry,
that.
VHS.
Yeah, yeah. I spotted that and I was like, yeah, sick. Put that on, Kev. Let's just have that for the next, like, hour. Oh, actually, we'd probably make the film a 3-hour film.
Oh, my God.
On a Bruce Lee video.
Yeah, he does some shit. Like, he rides a sledge down the stairs. That bit looks all right. The mum has landed in Paris. She's trying to call everybody that they possibly know to get someone to visit the house, but it's Christmas time, so nobody's home.
Now, this is bullshit. So even if everybody they're like, oh no, like everyone out in the street, they're all out. And then they phone later and they're like, oh no, I guess they're all out Christmas shopping. Does no one have an answer phone? Because they did.
That's true, they did.
They had an answer phone. They phoned the police. The police are fucking useless.
They just turn up and knock on the door and then leave.
Yeah, and also just like, there's no way that they cannot get hold of anybody in Chicago unless they are just the most reclusive and unpopular people ever. And I mean, they are horrible, so maybe. Maybe that's it.
I think that might be it. Yes, I agree. There's nobody to root for here until we get the only bit of sort of stakes, I suppose, when we're introduced to our boys, the Wet Bandits.
Okay, yes. Joe Pesci's back. He's not a policeman. Shock horror.
Can I point out that if anyone is listening and has a band called the Wet Bandits, you are not as clever as you think you are.
please
stop forming bands called the Wet Bandits. There's been a bunch.
I bet. Also, Macaulay Culkin, if you're listening, sorry I keep getting your name wrong. Are you still doing that pizza band? Probably should stop. It's shit. Anyway, back to the case at hand. We got our baddies, or are they the goodies?
Yes.
Because they're fun to watch.
So it's little Joey Fishes, Joe Pesci. He plays Harry. He's not a cop. He was just casing the joint at the start of the movie. He's got a gold tooth. That's his thing.
And it has a little Miss Piggy kind of like sparkle and ding, which is nice.
And his buddy is Marv, who is played by Daniel Stern. I really, really like Daniel Stern. You might have recognised him if you've ever seen the movie City Slickers, one of my guilty pleasures.
Oh, is he in that?
He's great in City Slickers. He's one of the three City Slickers.
Right.
He's also got a very famous voice because he's the voiceover guy in The Wonder Years. He's grown up Fred Savage.
Is he?
He is. All through The Wonder Years, he does the voiceover of that. So you expect to hear him talking about that time he almost kissed Winnie.
Ah, okay.
He's fucking great. And I love everything that Daniel Stern does. Slightly sad when I realised that when he made this movie, he's 1 year younger than I am now. Because I still feel like a child. And damn. He still feels like this sort of...
Older man.
Older man, vaguely paternal because I've heard his voice in The Wonder Years.
But, yeah.
And the passage of time, eh?
C'est la vie. Anyway, they're casing the joint. They were casing the joint. They're like, we're going to hit the McAllister's house because have you seen it? It's a fucking mansion. But then they're doing over another house, and their whole thing, they're the Wet Bandits because Marv likes to turn the taps on.
And flood the houses.
Whatever.
That's a nice little character quirk
nice little quirk. And then, yeah, they're going to go in there, they're going to rob the place, but then obviously Kev's there.
Yeah.
And he kind of spooks them out by, like, turning the lights on. He realises that people are sneaking around.
Yeah, there's some ineffectual stuff of just, like, back and forth of are they going to rob it, are they not? Every time they're about to, Kevin... you know, puts up like a shack cardboard standee in the window. So they think, oh, we can't rob it now. They've got shack round.
Yeah, well, he does. Yeah, when he does he creates a fake party in the house with a cardboard cut out of shack and just so many mannequins. Why are there so many mannequins in that house?
Well, there's a sewing machine in the basement.
Yes, I saw that. And I was thinking, like, is someone in the house a fashion? Is that how they've made?
Yeah, it's Buzz.
Buzz. Yes. Okay. Fair enough. Makes sense.
He makes miniature suits for his pet tarantula.
Oh, that's adorable. Yeah. Like, if you want to dress your tarantula up as like a total bro. Yeah,
broed out.
Yeah.
So we get a bit of that. We get Kevin goes to the store to try and buy a toothbrush. Then spooky old man Marley
turns up. This is all the like fucking kids wish fulfillment shit that you really want, isn't it? It's like, oh no, I don't have a toothbrush for some reason. Why don't you have a toothbrush, Kevin? You never packed your bag. You never left. But he's like, well, I better go out and buy one. And all the kids are going, yeah. Sledding down the stairs and... buying a toothbrush.
Yeah.
Okay. No adults.
Woo.
Bring on that laundry scene. He goes to the shops and... He buys detergent. It's not even that he does the laundry and uses the detergent they have at home. He goes and buys it.
And it takes him a while to work around how to even do that because he fails to buy the toothbrush because he has the IQ of a toothbrush. He can't work out how to buy it. He runs out the store, steals the fucking thing.
It's because he's scared by
old man Marley, whatever, like vagueness. the worst thing in the film happens when he's running away from the policeman who's trying to catch him.
Yeah.
And he crosses like an ice skating rink, falls on his knees, and there's a really long shot of him on his knees going, whoa, wow, wow, wazzle.
Yeah, that bit, I was like, oh, this is a bit much, isn't it?
Mate, hour 45, that couldn't have found its way to the cutting room floor. Well, had to be in, did it?
Well, there's that. And then there's all these bits when he runs around the house in slightly sped up motion with his arms over his head. And there's like shout at the camera cam that is at the top of the landing where he will run up the stairs, turn right, run at the camera, and then turn around and go the other way to go to where all the other rooms in the house are. And this must be the bit that you're pointing out where he's realised that he's in a film.
Yeah, and what does he do? He screams because of the existential horror of realizing there's a camera there filming everything I'm doing. Why? Ah!
And he's pushing the boundaries. He's like, where's the wall? Where is the wall between me and the audience? The fourth wall. And he's trying to break it. And then eventually it crushes him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if anyone's ever seen David Lynch's Inland Empire, it's basically Home Alone 2. It's the real Home Alone 2.
Yeah. Because after the toothbrush bit, he just kind of realises, oh, this is depressing, isn't it?
I've
got absolutely no restraints, no authority, and I've just gone and shoplifted a toothbrush. Fuck.
So then we get him, because his arc has ended here, there's a vague bit about him supposedly being scared of the boiler in the basement. Second time we see
Goes
the boiler,
nowhere.
He just walks down there and is just fine with it. So his arc's over. He's achieved independence exactly as he was supposed to. He's got nothing else to do. So what he does is he stoops to some Michael Winslow level shit of playing the VHS of Angels with Dirty Faces through the door to people who cannot recognise the sound of a TV.
Right. Think with this bit, I didn't mind it, but I liked it when they did it once.
Why is this in...
But then they did it twice.
Why?
Why do it twice?
The same bit. It's not that funny.
And the first time they do it, he does it and like, he just plays it and he's got this gangster murdering somebody and shooting him with a Tommy gun. And that scares off the pizza delivery driver. If the pizza delivery driver believed that, he should have called the fucking cops. Then he does it again. He does the bit again. He's like, I'm going to up the ante now. I'm going to do it and I'm going to use firecrackers. Why bother? It worked fine on the fucking idiot pizza delivery guy.
Yeah, it's the dumbest thing.
He should have played the Bruce Springsteen video.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not robbing that place. The boss is in there. he's got little Stevie on guitar. That guy's hard as nails.
Yeah,
he's
like fucking the pizza delivery guy knocks on the door and he just hears, hey, ha! Which is how Bruce Springsteen counts in all of his songs.
You like that? It's a very good point.
Thank you.
And this is the
scene. It wouldn't have scared me away. I'd have been more determined to break in.
It's the scene that gives us the line, keep the change, you filthy animal, which a lot of people repeat as Merry Christmas, you filthy animal, but that's not the line. I don't know why people like this line so much. It's of all the things to latch onto in the movie, why is it that and not Kevin, you're such a disease?
Yeah, or I wouldn't let you sleep in the room if you were growing off of my ass. Indeed. These are the questions that we're here to ask here at the Bitter End Podcast. Any home. So we've had him do his fucking Michael Winslow shit. Kevin, he goes and talks to Father Christmas.
Yeah, he goes and talks to Father Christmas. He's like, I wish my family away. Could you bring them back? And Father Christmas is like, oh, everybody needs a family.
Well, the thing I liked about this is like, he's talking to this like, you know, like, in the park, like, fake Father Christmas guy, and he's like, I don't want any presents, I just want my mum, my dad, and all my brothers and sisters, and maybe my aunt and my uncle, and my cousins. Do you think the Father Christmas got in his car and thought, poor kid, all his family are fucking dead?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because when he's saying it, it does sound like this kid's just kind of like, oh, hi, I'm a little orphan, and I don't have anywhere to live because everyone's dead.
I do. And
bleak.
That, yeah, I mean, that is bleak. It's also around this time, by the way, we're an hour into the movie here.
Yeah.
This is where we get quite a pivotal scene involving an extra. when Mrs. McAllister's trying to get the flight back from Paris, she said, well, there's a morning flight you can get. She's like, fuck that. I'm not getting the morning flight. Everybody else go and sleep at the hotel. They can get the morning flight. I'm going now. I'm going to go on like this squirrely-whirly roundabout route because everything's booked up because it's Christmas.
Planes, trains and automobiles, yeah.
Yeah, she does. She ends up in Scranton. Mm. And she's desperately trying to negotiate for a flight from Scranton to Chicago. Now, this is at the 58-minute mark. The man behind her in the queue while she's talking to the checkout guy, he's wearing like a brown jumper. He's got a big beard and he's got these kind of haunted looking eyes. There are plenty of people on the internet who are absolutely convinced that this extra is Elvis Presley.
Fuck off.
And when you look at it, I'm just saying, could be. Elvis.
Because it's a stocky white man.
Yeah. And if he'd gone into hiding, wouldn't you just for a laugh after a while pop up in a 1990 children's Christmas comedy?
This is ridiculous.
That's what I'd do.
Okay.
I'm just saying, if you've got a copy of the movie, guys, pause the film about 58 minutes in, have a look at the man in the jumper with the beard behind Mrs.
McAllister. See if it's Elvis.
Tell us if you think it's Elvis.
I'm going to spoil it for you. It's not Elvis. right. So, but who else is also in the background?
Well, okay, so this is the absolute most important bit of the film. And Tom, if you don't mind, I'd quite like to wax slightly lyrical.
Hit me with your wax.
So this is where John Candy comes in.
Whoop, whoop.
Everybody loves John Candy.
Much missed.
Heart and soul of whatever film he's in. R.I.P. Pour one out for Big John, the Candy Man. Now, he is standing in the background. He's a polka musician. He's there with his band. They're also stranded. They're renting a truck. And he hears Mrs. McAllister say,
if I have to sell my soul to the devil himself, I am going to get home to my son.
Now, it is at this exact moment that John Candy introduces himself to Mrs. McAllister, going, did I overhear you say that you would sell your soul to the devil himself in return for a trip to Chicago? Because, hello, yes. Now, there is no way that John Candy's character is not Satan. He absolutely is Satan. As he's explaining himself, explaining why he's there, he's wearing a yellow jacket. He's got his band jacket. It's this sort of nice, very prominent, vibrant yellow jacket. Quite an unusual colour. When she asks him who he is, he describes himself as being the polka king of the Midwest. Yellow jacket, polka king. Yellow king. He's the Yellow King, Tom. Now, the Yellow King is a concept from Robert Chambers' book of short stories called The King in Yellow. Now, The King in Yellow was... It was about a fictional play called The King in Yellow. That's the play within the book. And the idea is that anybody who reads the play The King in Yellow goes immediately insane because they're exposed to such evil. Now, this idea of The King in Yellow was the inspiration for the TV show True Detective. And that's where all of the kind of the satanic murder imagery, that kind of swamp bayou stuff comes from. That is why he's got the yellow jacket. That is why he's the Polka King. Just like having to pay the boatman to cross the River Styx, she pays with her soul, he offers a ride, and then they all cram into the back of this U-Haul, and they drive through the night, through the darkest night time, trapped in this windowless box, on their way to hell, condemned as they are, while she has to listen to the polka music, literally as they fiddle while her soul burns, on the way to the one thing that she was promised. That ride, so frivolous, to give away so much for something so little.
Right, okay. I mean, this is a dark, hot take, but I still believe this more than the Elvis thing. The Elvis thing is bullshit. This seems far more plausible.
Because while they're in the U-Haul, John Candy, the King in Yellow, Satan himself, the Dark Lord, he's saying, don't feel so bad about having forgotten your son, because we're all bad. Everybody in this windowless box playing these poker music, we're all really bad people. We've all tormented our kids. This guy over here can't remember his kids' names. This guy's got a son he's never met. This guy, you better hope that his kids never write a book about him. Me, I trapped my son in a funeral parlor with a corpse and he didn't speak for 7 weeks. Does that sound like a nice guy to you? No, he's evil, Tom.
Okay, all right. Well, you're turning me around on this theory. Interestingly, was it like, and it's quite obvious as well, John Candy improvised all of his lines, which is, you can kind of see it because the pace of the film suddenly grinds to a halt where you just see, like, I love John Candy in this and he's great, but he's operating at a very different kind of pace.
Yeah, and I think it's that kind of purgatorial kind of slowing down of time, because he's got eternity with her, right?
Yeah.
you know, now that he's in possession of her soul, there is no need to race to the finish line. He's got her on a hook.
But do you think that he snuck this in? Do you think John Candy snuck this in into the film? Like, because he's like, he was allowed to ad-lib it. Do you think he's like, no, I just think my character would wear a yellow jacket?
Yeah.
All right, Chris Columbus?
Hey? Yeah. Hey?
Hey, did you like this jacket? It's pretty good. How about we get, I think he'd be a polka musician, and all the other polka musicians, they're all wrongins. Yeah, we're wrong. Could you have her say something about the devil? It would be really funny in a kid's film.
John Candy, what an absolute genius.
So subversive.
Gone but not forgotten.
Yeah. Okay. So the mum, the villainous evil ratbag mum, is on her way to hell. Meanwhile, Kevin, he overhears the wet bandits. They've clocked that, like, no, it's just him at home on his own. The family isn't there. They're going to come and break in at 9 o'clock. They're like, we'll do it at dark, because it's perfect, because kids are scared of the dark. And it's also like, yeah, and also probably doing it in the dark is a better place to do burglaries.
You fucking dolts.
Come on. You don't do it in the middle of the day.
Kevin freaks out. He runs to the church for the most depressing scene his mum sold her soul to Satan. He's in a church. There's a choir singing. Easily 20, 30 kids in this choir. There are maybe 4 people in the audience.
Yeah, and it is a huge church.
Huge church. So the vast majority of their kids could not get one person to come and see them sing.
Well, I think because, you know, who else is in the church? Kevin goes in there like, yeah, I don't know, like... it's like the bleakest moment. It's like this real soul-searching moment. And who is there but the shovel slasher? Fucking, like, Jim Henson's ghost is haunting the church. And then they have a chat.
Bit of a heart-to-heart. Mr. Marley, the mean old shovel slasher, it turns out to be nice. He explains to McColney Kickles that the family is important, and that years ago he himself had a fight with his son, and they haven't spoken in years. Now, Tom, I ask you,
yes,
what do you think the fight was about?
Oh, that is a good question. Whether Die Hard counts as a Christmas film or not.
It fucking doesn't. Just because a film is set at Christmas does not make it a Christmas film. It has to be a film about Christmas. Die Hard is not about Christmas. It is set at Christmas. It could easily have been a Halloween party. Could have been a Hanukkah party. Could have been an Easter party. It would have been the same fucking film. It's not a Christmas film, guys.
I mean, I'm not entirely... I think this is something we shouldn't really get into too deeply, but... I do feel that the setting of Christmas does, it lends itself to that film a bit more. Halloween party, the police would be out there. It's Christmas. Everything's abandoned. The world is different at Christmas. It is not at like Easter or Halloween or any other time.
So what, you're telling me that the terrorist plot would have... I mean, it still doesn't work in Die Hard. They still fail.
I mean, it doesn't...
They would have failed quicker if it was Halloween. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't care because I love Die Hard.
Tom, your reasoning is bollocks. It's a good film. It's just not a Christmas film. Shut up. That is the end of it.
There's no talking to some people, is there? Anywho. What do you think the argument was about?
I think it was... the argument was about why Mr. Marley murdered his wife with a shovel.
That was what the argument was. Oh, yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
I think basically Mr. Marley murdered the wife with a shovel. The son was like, Dad, do that.
Oh, yeah, because he's obviously done some dark shit because he's like, there's a lot of rumours here around me, but that isn't true. And because it's not just something that Buzz has made up. It's like, it just seems like everyone in the neighbourhood of like fucking like millionaires are just kind of like, oh, yeah, Jim Henson's ghost, he's a wrong'un.
Well, because the parents must be repeating those rumours as well, because otherwise, like, Mr. Marley's not going to be around the kids to hear the stories are saying, unless he's listening in on the kids.
And there's this whole bit, there's a bit where you see that Mr. Marley has a cut on his hand.
Oh, yeah.
And you see it twice in the film, and it's very prominently shown, and you never find out what that cut, what, you know, like, Kevin goes, oh, how'd you cut your hand? And he's like, oh, yeah, like, murdering your mum. John Candy delivered her to me. And I've choked her to death and shoveled her.
It's dark. For a kid's film, the subject matter is quite dark.
Anyway, but the important thing, what I wanted to say was, I think the reason that the church is so quiet is because it's a rehearsal.
Oh, is it a rehearsal?
Yes, there's a very important point to be made there. Anywho, Mac and me Culkin, he's got to go and fucking weaponize a house. He doesn't want to be like, oh, the fucking shovel murderer. He's a nice old man. I could tell him that 2 criminals are planning to come to my house at 9 o'clock. And we can phone the police and bish, bash, bosh. He's like, nah, better go weaponize the house.
Yep, and it is here an hour and 14 minutes into the film that something starts to happen. That the thing that people think this film is all about suddenly starts happening an hour and 14 minutes in. This is where you get your wacky violence montage.
And what do you think of this wacky violence montage?
So at first, I was very cynical about it. I was watching it with arms folded. I made one note, which is a bunch of cartoon violence ensues. Definitely laughed my ass off when I saw it as a kid. Here now, at the tender age of 34, it kind of hit me a little softer. I was like, yeah, I think I'm a little bit old for this. But then Daniel Stern got an iron dropped on his face, which left a big red triangle.
Yeah.
That got a smile out of me. Then Daniel Stern stepped on a big nail.
Yeah.
That actually made me chuckle.
Okay.
And then little Joe Fishes got a flamethrower on his hat and his head caught fire. And then I laughed. And then my heart melted like the Grinch, Tom. And then I was into it.
That's nice. Okay, so my takeaways from this bit. When they're like knocking at the door, going like, kid, we know you're in there. It's me, Joe Pesci, and the tall guy. Meh. And then Michael Stern's like, kind of like, this is like, yeah, it's Santa Claus and his elf. And Joe Pesci turns up and looks at him, and he gives the biggest, cheekiest fucking grin. He's like, that was a good one. And I just really like, okay, wind it in, Joe Pesci.
Low key, yeah?
It's not that. Well, actually, I think that like they both thought the film was going to be shit, so they just went completely ham on it. I don't know why you would do that if you're just kind of like, this film's going to be shit. I'm just going to like go absolutely bananas. And then Joe Pesci gets shot in the dick.
Yeah, he gets shot in the dick with a BB gun. There's another key Pesci bit, which I know comes up in the second film, where he gets his hand burned on a hot doorknob.
The blood-curdling scream that he exudes when that happens. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
That's pretty like, oh, that's horrible. He's fucking branded. That is in his flesh.
Yeah.
And then when he gets the top of his head burnt, the top of his head is raw. That dude is, like, the top of, that's fucked. That is fucked.
You know what I said when that happened?
What?
Your ball, but he was bald to begin with, unfortunately. But
oh no, he had just quite close crew cut, bit of a widow's peak.
During this whole scrap, there's the moment where I hate Mac and Cheese Culkin the most, where he looks straight into the camera and he goes, "You guys give up, or are you thirsty for more?"
Oh yeah, that's
not funny. It's not clever. It's just fucking hateful.
And that's the bit that gets used all the time in like trailers and like clip shows. And it's like, oh no, fuck off Mac and Cheese. Ugh. Anyway, he weaponizes the house. He murders them. They probably would have died by rights several times.
It's not that much violent. There's one bit where Daniel Stern has to whack Joe Pesci in the chest with a crowbar to try and kill the tarantula. That bit might have like possibly brought about cardiac arrest, or at least an arrhythmia. But the rest
broken
of it...
some broken ribs, puncturing a lung,
maybe,
something like that. There's a bit where Mac and Cheese is meant to zip wire out to his treehouse. It's obviously a bloke. He's the stunt man. He's a geezer, isn't it? It's just like... He suddenly puts on quite a lot of weight. it's quite funny. And then this is the weird bit, like... The end of this kind of capery chase scene slapstick thing is that Kevin runs into the house across the street that has been burgled.
Before, yeah, because the water's running with the wet bandits.
Yeah, but the thing is, he didn't know that that house had been burgled or that...
I think at this point he's finally trying to find an adult because he realises he's about to be overpowered by the wet bandits.
The thing is, he phones up the police halfway through. He's trying to murder Joe Pesci in the tall one. He phones up the police and goes, "Hello. My house is being burgled. I live at such and such and such a street. My name is Murphy." And I was like, was he doing a RoboCop impression? And then...
Then Mr. Marley turns up.
But he's given an address that is not his address. He's specifically done it like, I'm not going to get caught at my house. I'm still not going to get caught living home alone. I'm going to purposely go lead the burglars over to this other house...
Weird, isn't it?
It's very weird. I don't know why he's done that. But yeah, the wet bandits get him, and then Mr. Marley shows up.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's not his house either. So why is he there?
Why is everyone in this people's house?
Yeah. So super weird. Marley shows up, bonks him with a shovel. Cops come and arrest him. Fine. The fun's over an hour and a half in, but there's still fucking 15 more minutes of movie.
Kevin cleans up. Goes to bed.
Yeah, cleans up miraculously quick. Then this is where we get the kind of the coup de grace.
Mm.
Kevin's mum finally comes home, dropped off by...
the devil?
By the Candyman, yeah. And he's like, see you real soon.
Yeah.
Oh, you're mine. You're mine. And she sort of sadly walks in, and you know, her breath doesn't leave a mist on the mirror, and she passes everything. She's got no reflection. You know, she's so hollowed out. She walks in. Kevin's still a dick. She's still a dick. And she's like, oh no, it was all for nothing. And then the ultimate cruelty, immediately afterwards, all of her family walk in the door. They were there. And she's like, how did you get back? And the line is, we took the flight that you said you didn't want to get, remember?
Yeah, that was all for nothing. And you sold your soul.
For nothing. And you know that on the cutting room floor, the one thing they did cut, the only thing they cut from this whole movie, is immediately after that, she looks out the window, completely pale and bloodless. And John Candy is waving at her, being like, oh yes, it was all for nothing.
Anyway. The thing is, like, the responses of everybody when they go, like, we have flown to another country, and this is a long-haul flight from America. This takes a long time at Christmas. This is massively neglectful. Like, the dad comes in, is like, oh, hey, Kev, how you doing? Hey, buddy, hey, how are we going? Hey, I'm going to go watch the game. Like, all these brothers and sisters just walk in. They don't give a flying fuck. They're like, I'm going to go and play my Nintendo.
I'd have been like, mate, do you know what your fucking carbon footprint is now?
Yeah.
For 15 people to fly transatlantic and back for no reason.
It just, everyone is just, it seems they all come in, and the mum is kind of like, I'm sorry, let's not mention this to anybody. Like, they're sweeping under the rug.
Well, the mum's got bigger problems now because of the whole Candyman situation.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. But then, at the end of this, I was like, huh, yeah, okay. I mean, that's cool. And I probably would have more fun time if this was, I don't know, the 23rd of December and I was watching this with some other people. And then the end bit is you get the redemption of Shovel Man.
Yeah, he's there talking to his son, and the granddaughter's there. So they've made up, I guess he's like...
And this was beautiful. I love this bit.
Yeah.
This was great. And I was like, oh, an hour and 45 minutes in. There we go. There's the heart of the film. Shovel Man's happy.
Why didn't we get to see, like, that story?
Yeah.
I just feel like Shovel Man's story is so much more interesting.
There's two Shovel Man stories. There's, like, the one of him being a murderer. And then there's just, like, this, like, kind of, like, real dark, you know, emotional, like, Oscar bait kind of story.
Yeah, of an old man reconnecting with his son on Christmas Day. And then you know what happens? The credits roll, and the very first credit, production manager, Mac Bing. Good
Bing.
Name, innit?
Good name.
Both Mac and Bing, I love.
Yeah, okay. And that's the film.
That's the end of that.
Okay, well... Merry Christmas, you fuckers.
Merry Christmas, you're such a disease.
Yeah. See you in hell, quite literally.
Yeah. And extra exciting for me because probably in about 6 weeks, I'm going to be watching again with my family. But I will know about the Candyman.
I'll know all about the Candyman.
So, yeah, it's a good film. I think you've definitely got to be in the right mood for it.
Yeah, like... I don't know. I wonder how a few people feel about this, like, are new to this. They didn't grow up with it. You know, like a kid today. You plonk a 10-year-old in front of this. Are they going to love it? Are they going to find it boring as shit? Because there's a big nostalgia thing behind this train. Like, this was a load of fun when I saw it at the cinema, but, like, I don't know.
A guy I work with has a daughter under 10 who he tried to get to watch the movie last Christmas, and the story goes that she was loving it up until the Shovel Man comes up, and then she was too horrified to continue watching the movie. Traumatic.
Well, kids films, like 80s and 90s kids films, definitely went darker. They went darker and they weren't afraid to.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
All snowflakes now, mate.
All right, Tom. So do we need to talk about Part 2, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Now, we've both seen this, right?
Oh, yeah. I remember definitely going and seeing this in the cinema. I'm sure I saw the first one in the cinema, but I have more of a vivid memory that going to see 2 at the cinema was a thing because I'd seen the first one and, like, my parents being like, how have they made a second one? How could the parents be so neglectful as to do this again?
Tom, could it be that Home Alone 2 was your first sequel?
Yeah, quite possibly. Yes.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Probably my first sequel. Hey-o. And I remember I loved it.
Great. Yeah, I thought it was
great. We're doubling down on bad guys. Obviously, the Wet Bandits come back.
Yeah.
And then we get Pennywise himself, Tim Curry.
Yes, right. Absolutely. I'm assuming he's going to be the sort of the Satan character this time.
Yeah. And then we get Big Bobby, Rob Schneider. He's in there.
Yeah.
And then obviously the real villain of the piece.
Donny Dickbag.
Fuck off, Trumpo.
Yeah. Donald Trump pops in and we will have plenty to say about that. Well, that is going to be a real adventure. So
stay Christmassy, folks.
Stay Christmassy, if you will. We hope you have enjoyed the start of season 8 of The Bitter End. We hope that whatever time of year it is that you're listening to this, you remember whatever family are most important to you. They don't have to be the ones you're related to. They just got to be the people that won't sell their soul for no reason or forget you at Christmas.
Yeah, you just be careful about men in yellow jackets. You know, that said, we miss you, John Candy. You big devilish bastard. Anyway, till next time, I'm Tom Denny.
I'm Todd Jordan. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter at BitterEndPod or on Facebook at BitterEndPod. And hey, please do tell your mates about the podcast. If you know someone that likes podcasts and hasn't heard of our show, please correct that gross mistake.
Yeah, that would just be cracking. So we're going to go and drink some eggnog and we'll see you next time because it's fucking Christmas all over again. We do Home Alone 2, the one in New York.